And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Visit DirecTV.com. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
The Athletic.
The Phil Hayes Show.
Welcome to the show. The Phil Hayes Show is brought to you by The Athletic and The Square Ball. I'm Dan Moylan. I'm from The Square Ball. I've got Michael Normanton.
Hello.
And Phil Hay from The Athletic.
Hello.
The big Black Friday sale is on at the minute. Take advantage of the best deal of the year. It's a quid a month for 12 months. But the offer ends at midnight on Monday, November 29th. So move on that one quickly. You get the great analysis, in-depth features that Phil does from the very best football writers around, ad-free versions of the podcasts. And Phil, tell me something that's on there this week that will entertain me.
We have a very big read on Kike News among football fans, including quotes from a fan called Michael, not his real name. And I must point out, it's not actually Michael Normanton, as somebody suggested on Twitter. I don't know what I'd have called Michael, actually, if it had been you. Ken. Coach Ken, yeah, that
Daniel,
that would have been perfect. But yeah, so lots of voices in there, police, government officials, and so on, and a lot of evidence that nobody's really doing anything about it, and it is getting pretty prevalent at the moment. There is also an exclusive interview with Luke Ayling this week, and we've had a very deep look at why Leeds are not the same attacking team this season as they were last season.
We'll get into some of that Luke Ayling stuff as well in part two of the show, but it did pull on the heartstrings a little bit. Actually, it's quite an emotional. An emotional interview, isn't it? He puts it all on the table.
I like interviewing Ayling, and I like speaking to him, particularly in periods where it's become a little bit difficult or the season's not going so well, because he is a bit of a voice of reason, and he tends to be both as honest as he can be about what's going on, but also fairly positive presence. And I thought he struck the right tone in it. And was it about himself, you know, about his game, where he's come from and where he thinks he's going? He was very honest, yeah.
Don't spoil it, because we've got to talk about this more in part two. And also, we've got the clickbait headline there as well. Phil Hay likes it when Leeds don't do well. That's what I took from that. The best offer of the year is available for you now. TheAthletic.com/LeedsPod. TheAthletic.com/LeedsPod to take advantage of that. Best deal of the year. Into the football then. And Spurs, last week you said you thought Spurs would nick it, Phil. I'm annoyed that you're right, because I thought we could get something from that game. And to be honest, we could have done, couldn't we?
I think I said that Leeds would play well enough to deserve something, which I think they probably did. But with it being Conte's home game, Spurs would eventually nick it. It did feel as if there was a proper rocket up the arse from Conte at halftime, because I think Spurs will feel in the end that they did enough. And I can see that argument. But they were pretty woeful in the first half, and Leeds were very good, very balanced. It was a different system from Bielsa, but it worked. I thought it brought the wingers and, to an extent, the fullbacks, certainly Pascal Struijk, more into play, similar to how they'd played against Leicester. And it looked good at halftime. It was set up nicely, but there was that feeling in the second half. And the moment Kane hit the post right in the first seconds after the second half started, there just was a very big switch and a swing in the balance of the game. And suddenly a Tottenham midfield, which had been absolutely nowhere for 45 minutes, came on strong, started to get on top. And I did feel it at 1-0 down, even, that it was going the wrong way after halftime. And certainly at 1-0, it felt like it was Spurs that were going to win it.
There was a lot written and said in the wake of Calvin Phillips' interview in the post-match, so we should probably deal with that. In terms of, was there any thinly veiled criticism of Bielsa? Because that was one of the things that people took from that, was there? But also, was he right about the idea that we should have been maybe more pragmatic? Because as soon as they started getting the run on us at the start of that second half, I thought, I know exactly where this is going.
You said to me on WhatsApp, and we seem to say this every week because we sort of chat through the game intermittently. You said we kind of need to slow this down now, but we won't. And that's how it felt. And that's what didn't happen. There were attempts by Bielsa to make that happen, or at least to shore up the midfield, which is where the problem was developing, which definitely didn't work. And in the end, he found himself making about two or three changes there, none of them to great effect. I don't think it's right to say that the change of moving Phillips into midfield was a big factor in the defeat, because that came around the hour when Firpo came on, and Firpo came on after the first goal. And I certainly felt by that stage that they'd lost their grip and that Spurs were heavily on top. I'd be surprised if it was veiled criticism of Bielsa from Phillips. I wouldn't be surprised if it was more criticism of the players themselves. You know, that idea of having to manage themselves on the pitch in a way that I think they have done more and more since Bielsa's first season. In this piece we've done for the back end of the week, looking at the kind of dip in attacking output and stats at Leeds this season, I was looking back at Bielsa's first season and looking at some of the numbers involved in the games. You know, games where they had 36 shots on goal and 45 crosses and crazy numbers like that. And that was the most adventurous I think they've been. It's not to say that they're not an adventurous team now, but I have felt little by little that there has been this sense of the players almost regulating themselves in games where they can feel that a point's there for the taking, but not necessarily a win. And that was that kind of felt how it had to be on Sunday. It felt in the second half that when they started going punch for punch with Spurs, or when they started trying to take the heat that Spurs were putting on them, that they were going to lose the game. And it wasn't a surprise in the end that they did.
It doesn't necessarily have to be like doing what Wolves did, which is to go down and stay down, although that is one method you can use to slow a game down. But you can be smarter in possession as well, can't you? You can keep possession for longer periods, you know, even if it's a case of knocking it around the back and making Spurs come onto you, that kind of thing. But that's one of the things that Leeds have done badly this year, isn't it, is to concede possession cheaply. When we're at our worst, we've given the ball away a lot. Now, we didn't in that first half against Spurs, so it makes you wonder why they couldn't maybe just switch onto that idea.
I think having a midfield again has helped us to do that. I think we, in the early part of the season, when we had seemingly Calvin doing the job of about three midfielders by himself, I felt like possession was more of an issue. But Forshaw has helped things massively, and him going off, I think, probably did negatively affect that side of it. But it did just feel like we lost our way a bit at some point, and maybe it was the increased pressure they were putting on, or maybe it was just that our own game wasn't working. But I kind of agree with Phil that by the time that we got an hour in, you could feel the game slipping away. And without really, I guess this is where the lack of strength on the bench comes into it as well, without anything coming on that you can think, oh, well, that's going to unbalance them in some way, bringing on a Rafinha or a Rodrigo or someone like that. But there was nothing on there, was there?
The problem in the first half for Spurs was that they could not link the lines at all. So they were getting nothing from Højbjerg or from Winks, and it was totally disconnected. And they were basically looking for Kane or Son to try and do something with very little possession. And that changed in the second half. Conte just seemed to, I don't know what he said at half time, but it wouldn't surprise me at all if he'd said to them, look, I mean, I said in the piece that I wrote after the game, in the first half, Conte was probably seeing a lot in Leeds that he wanted to see in Spurs, which was really good pressing, real ambition in the play. That whole thing Bielsa was talking about last week of attacking in numbers but not getting left short at the back, defending in numbers but not being negative when it comes to getting forward, it was all there. And it did feel a little as if Conte might have said to the players at halftime, you can't play like this. You know, this is not how you're going to play under me. And you need to make more effort, particularly for a crowd who were not wildly engaged in the game up until that point, has to be said. I agree about Forshaw. I found that one strange. I don't know whether he was a little bit short of fitness, but it didn't seem to me like that was going to particularly help. I was impressed with Gilhard on Sunday, without a doubt, but I do think, again, when it comes to holding the ball up and when it comes to playing higher up the pitch, I suspect that Bamford at nine is going to help you in that respect. And Michael's right, it does all kind of lead back, not entirely, because there are tactical issues as well, but it does kind of all lead back to the number of players who are missing, the depth on the bench, which is non-existent, and the number of game changers or winners, you know, game winners on there. It's not enough. And This repeats something that we said a few weeks back, and it might well have been after the Southampton game. There are an awful lot of matches now that we seem to go to, and this is in part, you know, no small part down to the absentee list, but where you think to yourself, if they get into trouble today and if they need help from the bench, it's very hard to see where it's coming from because so many of those players are completely unproven.
It's Tyler Roberts. Every single week is the problem, and it's boring to talk about Tyler Roberts again probably, but he doesn't regularly change a game, does he, when he comes on? Not enough anyway. So I think as well, you look at the bench, it was strange. We were in here on Wednesday with Hayden trying not to hype up Archie Gray. And then a few days later, he's with the first team as a 15-year-old travelling down. And you think, that's not maybe going quite so well for him.
Yeah, back in time for school on Monday. It doesn't feel like this is doing Roberts any good particularly. It doesn't feel like the way he's been used is doing the team any good either. I say it all the time, but it goes beyond him. You need on the bench four to five players that give you options to change it in different positions and to give you somebody who can step into, you know, obviously move Phillips forward, but it didn't particularly work. But Phillips was actually doing pretty well at centre back. I liked him in that role. And it was quite interesting because These days, your top coaches think less and less with centre-backs about heading ability and the old, you know, being able to clear it to the halfway line. It's all about touch and vision and passing and everything else. And Leeds definitely need Phillips in a slightly more advanced role, I think. Forshaw is definitely the closest match to him. And he's, I think, the one player who you can ask to play there. But if you had a really high calibre midfield, I can see a lot of merit in Phillips at centre-back because you get a really top-class passer of the ball in that deep area and somebody who's very physically robust. But minus Rafinha and Rodrigo and Bamford and Ayling and others, how do you change it significantly? How do you change it in a way where, for example, I'm reading the book, or I've read the book, The Immortals by Arrigo Sacchi, which is brilliant, actually. And one of the fascinating things about that...
Oh, I read books in Italian, fancy.
No, it's translated. This is why I didn't read it in 2019. Yeah, I had to wait for the plain English version.
Or sat there with a dictionary word by word.
But he talks in there about, in his view, tactics are a negative thing because tactics are what you do when you're trying to negate the opposition. Strategy is what you do in a sort of positive sense. And I think Bielsa would very much agree with that. And it has all been about strategy with Bielsa at Leeds. But with the bench, and just to touch on that book as well, it's actually amazing when you read it. The number of things that Sacchi talks about that sound like Bielsa speaking is astonishing. It's like they're not identical coaches in any way, but they think about the game and, you know, there's a lot of similarities in the way they look at it. But it felt on Sunday, and it's felt in other games, like you get into situations where because of what's on the bench, you have to pretty much negate what's going on the pitch rather than being able to be proactive and to be positive, you know, kind of positive with changes that are going to make a big difference to the game. And it is a problem.
You can't magic a Premier League squad out of thin air, though, can you? This is the thing that follows from that point. Because I don't disagree with you at all. I mean, on our show in the wake of this, Moscow and I had words. We exchanged words about strategy and transfers,
yes,
and so on and so forth. We're all good friends. It's fine. And his point was, well, who do you sign then? And I was sort of saying, well, you know, I don't have access to the data, but how do we square this circle? That if you can't magic a Premier League squad out of thin air and you're on a limited budget, whether that's through, you know, financial fair play or just the limitations within the finances of the club, what do you do about it right now, you know, end of November, going into December? How can we address this for the rest of the season?
Well, this was the gist of the post-match article that we did after Spurs, which was that I still feel that at full strength, Leeds have ample quality in the team and ample quality in the squad, you know, in the 20. But they're never at full strength. This is the thing, they never are. There are always players missing. And I know clubs everywhere have injuries, and managers don't tend to sympathise with each other over injuries because the job is the job. And actually, part of the skill of coaching is not just having the luxury of everybody you want to pick being available. You know, you have to be inventive, you have to be creative, and you have to train everybody to be able to cope with filling in from time to time. But the injury list has always weighed pretty heavily on Leeds in terms of numbers. I think it's weighing on them more heavily this season in terms of the impact it's having on results. And the fact that it's worked for Bielsa for 3 years doesn't necessarily mean that it's working in the same way now. You're right about what you say, and to an extent Moscow is as well, about what you do in the transfer market. I was writing in the piece and saying that this might be a window where everybody, Bielsa included, has to show a little bit of pragmatism. From Leeds' point of view, if Bielsa isn't going to be here next season, if he's going to go in the summer, they need a squad which is well-positioned and well-built up in order for the next coach to take on. And I think on that basis alone, there might be an argument that some business in this window would make sense to get them ahead of where they need to be next summer. And actually, I think Bielsa can see himself that he is short in midfield. But it just felt to me again that looking at that bench, it was hard to avoid the fact that they do seem to be perennially short of options and depth. And it would seem to me that they don't really at the moment have the luxury of sitting this window out. I don't think they need to do a massive amount of business in the window, and things will depend, you know, form and results are going to depend on who stays fit, who comes back, who is able to have a sustained run of games. But I think it's hard to deny that the players who have been missing have definitely affected them, and they don't look strong enough.
Because people are going to leap on it. You mentioned Bielsa, this being his last season. Why? Why would you say such a thing?
Well, no, it's purely the fact that he goes season to season and he's got a year's contract. So if he had a 2 year contract, then you would think to yourself, well, you know, most likely he's going to be here next season. Because he's got a 1 year deal, they will either go their separate ways or they will renegotiate next summer. But at some point, some 1 year deal is going to be his his last. And I do think that this squad needs built up a little bit. I do think it is short. What you do in January depends on budget. And one of the reasons that Leeds don't like January particularly is because it isn't a time of particularly great value. And we've gone over all this, you know, the fact that Bielsa likes certain players, likes players to have a, you know, pretty exact remit. One of the quotes I think that jumped out after the game was him saying, to sign players who are either at the level or above the level of what we have costs 20 to 30 million. I think that's true of the best player at minimum. I think that's true of the best players Leeds have, true of a lot of the players in the starting lineup. I don't think it's true of that bench on Sunday. And it seems to me that there must be some scope to just create a little bit more in the way of resources that protect them through the second half of the season. I mean, we are into December almost, and, you know, they are where they are in the league. And we are probably starting to get beyond the point now where you can say, well, do you know what? They've played well in patches, which they definitely have. I mean, the best periods of the performances against Leicester and Tottenham were really good, you know, really, really well good. But they do need points on the board.
It's a game of fine margins as well, isn't it? Like we saw with Spurs, you know, like that free kick deflected, hits the post, comes back out, they score. The momentum of the game has switched even more in Spurs' favour. So it's not like we could potentially, I'm going to drop the R-bomb now, but get relegated by an absolute pace in every single week. It doesn't feel like that. But if you continue to fail to get points on the board, but like we were saying about the Spurs game, it felt to me like that was only ever going to go one way because of the things we've touched on, like the lack of depth from the bench. And I agree with you. I think that just, and it's the point I was trying to make to Moscow, was we need to just sort of backfill the squad a little bit, just a couple of bodies maybe here and there. So you've got somebody solid who can come on. Who that is, I don't know. I don't have the answers to that.
To say as well, you need to spend 25 million quid would be to overlook the fact that our midfield against Spurs was Click, who was a million and a bit, and Adam Forshaw, who was like four or five million quid. So there are players available. Maybe it'll take them time to get up to speed or whatever. But
good players, it doesn't. It doesn't take them that long, does it? Surely. It's just the fitness.
I always quite like somebody like Harrison Reed at Fulham, and I'm not saying Harrison Reed is, you know, the sort of player you're going to get 10,000 people down to.
That will be clickbaited.
Well, it probably will, which is why I didn't really want to mention it. But
I can't wait to hear Danny Mills' opinion on it in a week.
You're not going to get 10,000 people coming down to, you know, crowd outside Elland Road for a glimpse of Harrison Reed, but players who could chip in and contribute. And let's not get stuck down the Conor Gallagher rabbit hole. But I do remember the negativity when his name came out, and that, you know, there have to be surely players out there of that ilk.
Let's take a left turn onto that then, because that taps into the sort of broader strategy, doesn't it? And the fact that actually it looks like by going for Gallagher, it would have been a really shrewd move if they've managed to get him for this season, because he's performing really well in the Premier League for Palace. And obviously we'll get on to seeing him on Tuesday, won't we, in the preview for Palace towards the back end of the show. Has the strategy been right, in your opinion? And when I say strategy, because that's quite a broad umbrella term, I'm thinking, is there criticism of Bielsa in this? I don't know. I'll let you deal with this one, Phil. Squad size, the type of players that they're going for, and the budgets and where they're allocating the money. Do all those things, have they got them right? You can't get it absolutely bang on right, I guess. It's not an exact science, but have they got it right enough at Leeds?
For 3 years, yes, it's worked. It definitely has. One of the things that was apparent in the analysis we did of the peak ages of Premier League squads, looking at when players are at the best and when they're likely to play the most minutes, was that certainly in a couple of areas of the squad, but particularly midfield, there wasn't much coming up behind. And it did, if you look through the squad, it did seem a little bit like they might have to think about recruiting more in that kind of key age group where players are almost at the peak or
just coming into
peak.
Coming into the mid-20s.
Yeah, they will never ever sign ageing players. They've never signed, I think Rodrigo at 29 is the oldest outfield player they've ever signed. And that makes sense because then you factor in resale value, you factor in potential and where they are in their career and hoping that you will get the best of them or very close to it. But there is a lot of potential, young potential in the squad. I mean, absolutely masses of it actually. But they perhaps need to just plug that slight gap of having players who are pretty much at full tilt at the moment. I accept that January is a really difficult time to do it. It's not a great time to be trying to overhaul things, but I don't think they do need to overhaul things. I think it is just, you know, a little bit more to make sure that on days like Sunday, there's the potential to be covered in a way that they just want.
And at the very root of this is that this club cannot afford to go down.
No, not at all. They know that. I think the good thing is that although it's been difficult through the months since the start of the season, it does feel like it's getting there despite the results. I think they'd be desperate to avoid is the situation that, say, Sheffield United had last season. I remember saying to you in one of the podcasts, I don't think Sheffield United have been that bad last season. I can't remember when it was, but I think midway through the season, you know, they kind of, there've been a lot of games where they could have taken something from it. And you said quite rightly, but the problem is that they haven't. And because they haven't, they're a mile adrift. Now, Leeds are not a mile adrift and are still above the bottom three. And Arsenal ticking over in terms of points coming little by little. But saying they played really well for one half is not going to be great if we're into November and into January or February and still having that conversation. I think these next three games are pretty important, because after that, there's some very, very difficult fixtures that might not yield a huge amount. And they do need to keep themselves moving forward.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Let's get into the weeds a little bit now then about Luke Ayling. You did a piece on him, interview with him on Thursday that went live then. A lovely bloke is Luke Ayling. I really took that from the documentary. It's the second season of Take Us Home. Just what a nice guy he is, and just putting it all on the line in terms of his vulnerability and his own self-doubt. And it was nice to hear a footballer talk in that and in this piece as well, like a human being and not through a PR machine.
Oh, he definitely does. And just to clarify something before you get me a kick in, when I said that he's a good person to speak to when things are not so great, what I meant is that he always speaks really well times like this. I remember him around the time of the Forest and Brentford game when, as somebody said to me, clearly he has a speech impediment and he's not an obvious pick for interviews, but he was adamant around that period that when there was media duties to be done, he wanted to do them because the pressure was on and he didn't want, you know, the younger kids having to come out and try and explain why it was that suddenly this, you know, the results were slowing up and things were starting to get difficult. He kind of said, if anybody's got to do this, it's going to be me. He is a great guy and he's a great story for a number of reasons. The first, and I always go back to this, but it's the fact that he's coming up for 200 appearances at Leeds at a cost of £200,000 from Bristol City. And I think even factoring in Hernandez, you would struggle to think of a better value for money buy than that in the past sort of 20 years or so. He's been phenomenally good at Leeds. And what you find out from talking to him is that his style of play has changed so much in these five and a half years that he's been at Elland Road. Not just under Bielsa, it must be said. He said himself under Gary Monk, and I remember this really clearly, he suddenly became this kind of end-to-end fullback, despite the fact that through his career at Arsenal, he'd been told he was a centre-back, but he wasn't big enough, strong enough, good enough really to play in the Premier League. He'd gone to Yeovil where he'd been a defensive mid, and then he'd been a right-back, but a very sort of defensive one, didn't get forward much. And I don't think he realised at all that he had this amount of energy in him. I don't think he realised that he had this style of play in him. And, you know, he spoke about the people who told him, you won't play at this level, you know, or you're not really good enough for this level. And they weren't trying to be harsh with him. They were just trying to be honest. And he said, if I'm being honest, I didn't think I would either. I thought at most I might get promoted with a club to the Premier League, but then find out that they didn't need me. And that would be that. And he's one of a few at Leeds who have just gone way above the kind of assumed high watermark for them, miles beyond it.
One of the big themes in the interview is the thoughts on why Leeds have struggled this season. And I noted that they saw this coming to a certain extent. They thought this season would be harder than last.
He said that, and actually I know that there were some in Bielsa's coaching staff who thought that as well. I think they just felt that doing it second time around was never going to be as simple as just bouncing into the league and finishing ninth again. Ayling said that when they came back for pre-season, they all said to each other, there's no way this season will be the same as last season. You know, it will be potentially more difficult. It probably will ask more of us. He was pretty honest about the fact that they haven't clicked, but one of the things that stood out was him talking about the extent to which he feels that the constant international breaks have been a hindrance for Leeds. And I suppose you have to marry that up by saying that at the same time, the breaks have come at times for a squad who've had injuries. So perhaps they've been, you could see it as helpful in that sense. But he feels, and he's probably right, that the international breaks tend to interrupt the rhythm that Leeds get. He was saying that, you know, a lot of championship players in that squad, a lot of players who've come up out of the championship where they were used to playing 50 times a season, they like playing 50 times a season, they like your midweek matches, which we've had virtually none of this year. That's not to say they like being in the championship, you know, it's just that it suited them to be playing all the time. And he, you know, he kind of felt that with 4 months ahead of them now, I think something like 19, 20 games before the next international break in March, he was really looking forward to that because, firstly, he's been out injured, but secondly, because this kind of stop-start, and we've moaned about this on the podcast, you know, this season it has felt like a couple of games, 2 weeks off, a few more games, 2 weeks off, and then, you know, yet another break that's just behind us. So he thought that that would make a difference. But I have to say, underlying confidence about where this is going and underlying confidence about the season being in hand despite the fact that it hasn't gone too well so far. And I always feel with Ayling that you tend to get very honest answers on that stuff.
I did laugh at the idea that there aren't enough games for Luke Ayling. Like, I found like the championship exhausted me physically and mentally. It was so stressful, and yet they actually want more of it. Not the championship, we should say, because we don't want another clickbait headline. Hey, reckons Leeds better suited to championship, agrees with Ayling.
But I think that's it, though. I think when they got into the rhythm, and bear in mind how many games they won in the championship and how well they coped with the kind of Saturday-Tuesday schedule, I think they often felt like they were on a roll. And it's not as if they want international breaks in that division either, but you could find that you'd played a massive glut of games in between them. So suddenly, actually, it was quite nice to get a breather. Whereas, particularly the first one that came this season, what did Leeds play? Like, 3 league games and 1 League Cup game against Crewe. I mean, you couldn't believe, really, that was that. And you were now going to sit back for 2 weeks.
Well, thankfully, we're not taking a month off next season for bloody World Cup in Qatar.
No, well, you know, this is it, isn't it? And the idea of kind of biannual World Cups just makes you think of how much more they'll be trying to ram in.
I did chuckle as well at his comments about even food, even as far as, like, you know, when the players go off to internationals, they eat differently to how they eat at Leeds, which is presumably starvation rations, judging by how thin they all are. I mean, does your eating pattern change during the international breaks?
No, it's as terrible in the international breaks as it is during the season. One of the things that I agreed with Neil Warnock on, and there weren't that many, was that if you work in football, it's terrible for your diet because you spend a lot of time, like we did on Thursday night, on Sunday night, coming back from Spurs at McDonald's. That is how it goes. But he's right. When you go away with England or other international teams, you will almost certainly train less than you would be training when you're at Thorpe Arch. You will eat differently. You'll do different things. It won't be, almost certainly won't be as intense. Like he said, you know, there's virtually no team anywhere that does exactly what Leeds do because of who the head coach is. But we got into talking about Bielsa, and I said to him, I think one of the things that has been apparent this season is that there hasn't been a down in the tools, and I don't think the players have sulked either. I don't think that you've had the body language which has said, we either don't believe in this or we don't have faith in it anymore or we don't trust that it's going to pick up. I do feel like they've been digging in for him. The crowd have been as well, and Ayling said, the thing is, we owe him, you know, he's completely changed our careers and our lives, so we owe him that. And that is the one thing that you can kind of rely on, is that they will fight it out for him.
Just to return to Ayling in a second, because you've just made me think of something there, talking about Spurs, just for anybody who wasn't there, what is that stadium like? Because I'd seen bits of their website, I think it was, or maybe via Wikipedia, whatever it might have been, that like the press area was essentially like the Google campus, like some sort of internet cafe or something like that. And just give us a little peek behind the curtain.
The press area is bigger than your average restaurant, I would have said. It is massive. And yeah, I mean, it does look like something out of Silicon Valley. And actually the whole stadium has a kind of NFL edge to it, I think. You can understand why NFL has been played there because it feels like, I don't mean it's geared for that as in they've built the stadium for NFL, but it's been built in a way which totally can accommodate American sport and has a lot that you'd associate with American sport. It is phenomenal. And the wall behind one of the goals, which holds, what, 17,500?
The quiet wall.
The quiet wall. I was trying to imagine the South Stand in there and the absolute havoc that would go on, 17,500 in that. But
well, mind you, the cop at Elland Road used to hold 17,000, if you can believe it or not.
Yeah, probably not in my day, though, doing it, I don't think. And it's the scale of it as well. It's the distance that it goes back completely unbroken. That's the thing. It's not like you don't find stands that are as big. It's just that one complete, you know, like the wall at Dortmund. It would be utterly impossible to do that at Leeds with the South Stand. But I tell you what, they should think about doing it with the North.
Well, I was going to say, yeah, the Kop needs to go back over the M621, doesn't it? Like that, just on stilts over the
motorway. Just leaning back over it, yeah.
Leave the West Stand then, because you love the West Stand, don't you, Michael? You love all the, asbestos, but yeah. just the ramshackle.
Jeopardy.
Yeah, the ramshackle thrown together nature of it all.
I mean, it's impossible to not be impressed by the Spurs ground in certain aspects of it. But then equally, I look at it and I think, nah, not for me. Not for me. Give me something a bit more...
The smells of piss?
Not necessarily. I mean, I would prefer it not to smell of piss at Elland Road. It's funny, actually, there was the Premier League survey came round. It was kind of a big multi-question thing about how would you rate various things at Elland Road? And it was like, you know, the food, the toilets. And I basically said they were all terrible. But then it said overall match day experience. And I was like, great. Which is weird because I think anyone looking at the figures of it would go, well, okay, well, then in that case, access isn't great. Queuing's a problem. Getting out the stadium takes too long. The food's bad. The beer takes too long. There's not a good enough choice of meals. But actually, I went, do you know what? That's good. I'm happy to leave it as it is.
You know the story earlier this week, I think it was in the Daily Mail, about the possibility of extending half-time to 25 minutes to allow for half-time entertainment, which, according to people who know about these things, is not going to happen. But it's actually...
It was just because it was floated by CONMEBOL, wasn't it? So they have to discuss
it.
Because it
is going to be discussed.
Yeah. Because somebody's put it forward, they have to talk about it, even if it's ludicrous.
Bring back the police dogs at halftime, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But do you remember the giant sumos that Sky first brought out for the Monday night football? Because they thought, people don't want to watch football on a Monday night, so we have to put razzmatazz into it. And it was the giant sumo wrestlers. And I quite enjoyed them, to be fair.
Yeah, but you don't want 25 minutes of it. And I think... I went to Spurs and I thought, I love this stadium. It's absolutely amazing. But then I think about Elland Road and I feel really affectionate about Elland Road. And I feel like the more that you sway away from stands with asbestos towards stadiums that are kind of NFL style, the more you sort of stray towards 25-minute half-times where you've got all sorts of entertainment.
Well, it's not like Leeds have got American owners in waiting, is it?
Well, not at all. But... the fact is, modern football needs a stadium that is different to Elland Road, sadly, and they will get one somewhere further down the line.
Disagree.
But we'll miss it, and we will. Assuming that stadium is ever developed, you'll talk in future about what it was like when it was raw and rough and ready.
Yeah, we'll be those old farts in the pub saying, "I remember it when it was asbestos and it was miles better than anyway."
Yeah, that'll be
going
back
to Luke Ayling. I want to ask the question: how much are Leeds missing players like Ayling this season? He wasn't in great form earlier in the season, but he is a leader in the dressing room.
He is. I think he's still around the dressing room. It's not as if he disappears for 2 months when he's injured. He was saying he tries to get in before every game.
But he's a big talker on the pitch, isn't he?
No, he is, and a big presence. I agree with you that I didn't think he was playing especially well, but he is definitely the most suited right back in the squad by a distance, I would say, to playing in the way that Bielsa wants his fullbacks to play. And that, I think, is where the big improvement has to come from going forward this season. In this analytical piece that we've done about the attacking style and the changes this season, without giving the game away, we've done some analysis of what's going on out wide, and it's quite revealing, the contrast from last season to this. Ayling helps massively with that because he understands the way that he's supposed to link up with the winger in front of him. He's very good at hitting the gaps and doing that thing which leaves defenders saying to themselves, I don't really know who to mark here.
It's the overloads, isn't it? It is, and that is
absolutely crucial in Bielsa's tactics. So a fit and firing Ayling, I still think, adds a lot to this team, and I think they will be better with him in it.
How much longer do you think he's got at Leeds, Luke Ayling? Because as we were saying, like, there's a core of this squad that's sort of floating around 30, 31-ish, maybe 30 towards 32 now, and with the best will in the world, there's only a few years left after that, at the top level anyway.
The interview ended on that question. I asked him, when you finished, they've all gone through this meteoric rise. So when you're as good as you are in the Championship, and I still think that, give or take, they were probably the best team in the season when they didn't go up. Maybe Norwich would argue with that. But I think the best of Leeds' performances were probably the best that anybody saw. And then deserved by a streak to win the title in the second season. This from a squad that Ayling was in when, you know, they finished a long way back, ultimately under Heckenbottom, didn't make the playoffs under Gary Monk. But then to finish ninth last season, do you start asking yourself, can I actually go any further? You know, have I hit the ceiling? And if Leeds are saying, you know, we want European qualification, does the doubt come into your head about, can I do that? You know, am I good enough? Am I too old now? Am I getting beyond it? It was similar. We spoke about England as well, and he was saying in that, said, you know, I'm probably 5 or 6 years too late, realistically, for England to be playing like this. But it was what he said, I thought was quite revealing, and you can read it and find out what he thought about that. But again, very honest about it. Wasn't just a case of, yeah, no, I'm fine, I'll be here forever. I think in answer to the question of how long will he be at Leeds, I don't think he knows. I don't think he would pretend that he does know, because he's sensible enough to realise that there will come a day where somebody says, look, we're kind of moving on.
And you wonder, don't you, about as players get older, if they fancy the demands of Bielsa's, demands really, the diet, the intensity of the training, the amount of the training, because it's all consuming, isn't it? The fact that they essentially move into Thorpe Arch for pre-season tells you a lot about the work that they do.
Not even the older players. I think it's probably more a case of, for anybody of any age, how long it's enjoyable for, and how, you know, how many years go by before you do come to the point of thinking, this isn't really for me anymore. I'm not getting that sense with the players this season at all, though. I've really never had the impression that many of them are sitting saying, do you know what, I'm sick of the diet and I'm sick of the hard work and this, that and the other. Don't get me wrong, there are times when it's really tiring and there are times when it must grate. But as they always say to you, the reason they've been as good as they have been is because of what they've done, and because they have all gone with it, and because Bielsa has pushed them this hard. And that's what it came down to with Ayling. You know, why they're fighting for him is because he's taking them to places that they never expected to go. And I honestly think it'll be a long time yet, I feel, before the dressing room en masse say, we can't do this anymore.
Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business, take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic. As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Right, we broke off there then for the Marcelo Bielsa press conference, the contents of which people will know about now. But let's reflect on what's been said in the run-up to Brighton and Palace then that we've got across the next week or so, Phil. And he's in the mood for a scrap, is Bielsa. He's in this for the long haul.
Yes. Also, I mean, injuries are looking better, it has to be said. Ayling is not going to feature this weekend, but is due to play for the 23s next week. So is clearly doing well, as we thought. Bamford and Koch are in the final stages of their recovery. Bielsa did say today, actually, that that Bamford's injury has been actually quite serious. And I think the bigger problem with it is not that it's a massively serious injury. I think it's one of those ankle ligaments where you can't be certain how long it's going to take. So that's, as he said, the evolution has been prolonged. But Shackleton is fine. Rafinha is fine. Rodrigo is fine. So a much bigger hand to play with against Brighton, and barring anything at the weekend against Palace as well.
Do you think that then puts us in a far better position than maybe we went into the Spurs game, just in terms of pure numbers is good? Do we have a better chance against Brighton then?
Well, clearly it does, and personnel will be better, and the range of players that he's able to pick from is better when you're talking about experienced players and proven players. I think it goes without saying that Rafinha will come back into the team, surely. I would imagine Rodrigo probably will as well, although it might be a little temptation to give Gilhart another go, because if they were to play better over 90 minutes as opposed to just one very good half, then you felt like there would be something in it for Gilhart. He's a proper shoot-on-sight striker and very good, I felt, at dropping deep and linking up and everything else. But I think it's still the case that he's going to be a little bit down the pecking order when everybody's available. But as I say, Bamford won't be back for this weekend. We did get onto the subject again, though, of squad size and transfers. And Bales has obviously been giving this a bit of thought since the weekend. And he's not given any ground on this. It has to be said, he went right the way through his squad and tried to make the point that he does have cover in areas if everybody's fit. He also said again, he doesn't want to be in a situation where he has players like Gilhart who are compromised in terms of the minutes they get because suddenly it's a bigger squad with more people who need to play. He also reiterated that he does feel like the club have invested heavily under him. He was named checking Koch and Rafinha and Rodrigo and Llorente and others. I still kind of lean towards the feeling that because injuries are so prevalent and because the squad is down on numbers so often, that a slight bit of work in January would help. But, you know, it's to a large extent his call, really, and that is where he stands on this. But there's no doubt that players coming back do change things, because some of the players who are out and some of the players who are missing on Sunday are massive parts of his team.
You would say as well, it's easier for a young player like Gilhart to come in when he doesn't have the weight of the entire fan base to rescue a game or something on his shoulders, because it is a lot for a young player to carry, isn't it? And we should actually say something about what he played like at Spurs, particularly in that first half, because while I do agree with you, I think he's likely to put Rodrigo back in because seniority tends to trump everything, doesn't it, in that squad. A really good performance in that first half against Spurs. You know, some shooting opportunities in that back heel as well.
Premier League performance, really. I think it's comprehensively answered the question in the past few weeks, month or so, about whether he's ready and whether he's up to it. We saw that in the closing stages against Wolves and more so on Sunday. I just think he's very clever when it comes to knowing the positions to take up. He's very comfortable with the ball at his feet and he likes running at players. But I like the fact that he's clearly looking to score goals all the time when he gets into that zone. You know, he's not a player who's particularly thinking about anything else, but it's not detrimental. You know, the player that sort of springs to mind when I think about that is Antonucci, someone who just seemed to shoot from anywhere when it got into his head that he was after goals. Whereas with Gilhart, he knows when he's in a good position, and, you know, his one particularly good shot in the second half that was well saved by Lloris. I do kind of fall on the side that thinks I'd like to see him play again. But having said that, there's no doubt that without him in the team, Leeds also played extremely well against Leicester. And there probably is a more balanced side. Even though it looked really balanced in the first half, I think against more, you know, different sides to Spurs in the Premier League, with everybody available, there probably is a more balanced team than the one that was out down at Tottenham.
What I like about Gilhart is just got that swag, hasn't he? He's kind of got that swagger, the confidence.
Inner confidence is exactly it.
He's a player as well, coming off the bench, I suppose I'd feel a sense of confidence that he would make something happen as well, whereas you did look at the bench against Spurs and there was nothing there that made you yearn for anything off it, I suppose. Whereas Gilhart, even if he's not starting games, I think he gives something exciting to look forward to in a game.
I think what you want to build up to is a scenario where you're being carried by your best players, your top players, so your Rafinhas and your Bamfords and others. But you have somebody like Gilhart who you start to feel increasingly optimistic about when it comes to changing games, you know, or to finishing games off. Somebody who comes off the bench and the opposition look at him and think, this kid's actually very good. You know, this is a good change for them. But the best thing, and this kind of applied to Creswell as well when he played against West Ham, was that you didn't look at Gilhart and think, well, there's obviously talent there, but not quite yet. I think it's putting far too much on him to think that he can play up there, up in that position for an extended length of time, he might be fine, but I think it's asking a lot. And the only position beyond the centre midfield that I think you could make an argument for strengthening in January would be centre forward, because there's no doubt that when Bamford is out of the team, it does seem to be a case of kind of rotation there, trying to find out who's best for it. And actually, maybe Gilhart is the best option there, perhaps more of a number nine than Rodrigo. But yeah, I wouldn't complain at all if he started again at Brighton.
Just turning our attention to Brighton then and the fullback positions, and there's probably a question mark about whether you put Strouk in at left back or rather leave him there. Would you leave him in there, particularly as we've noted in the last season that Brighton have some absolutely gigantic fullbacks?
I think I would leave him there on form at the moment. I think he's played well in that position, and actually kind of defying his massive size and physique that doesn't look like it should suit a wide position to be pretty effective. I thought he was good against Leicester. I thought he was good against Tottenham as well. And I like his aggression at getting up the field. He's what you have to be a wing back in a Bielsa team, which is to be ambitious going forward, but to be able to recover as well and to be able to get back and make sure that you don't leave massive zones in behind you. I mean, given that Firpo is on the books, Firpo is the player that they need to develop into that out-and-out left-back or left-wing-back longer term. But, you know, Bielsa name-checked Strouk today and said he's done well in the past few games. I totally agree with that. And it would seem slightly strange to change that. I think it would more likely be a case of picking him on form rather than picking him because of what Brighton have got in their team.
And the way we play seems to blur the boundaries a little bit between fullback and midfield. Like you saw the way that we had lined up with, like, for example, Llorente pushing out towards the right, Phillips dropping into centre half against Spurs, which meant that Dallas could push forward into midfield. And that Strouk, you know, you've seen him in possession, absolutely no problem knocking the ball about, taking it down. He's very accomplished, isn't he?
Well, you remember what Bielsa said a few weeks back, which is that there isn't really any such thing now as a winger and a fullback. They both have to be able to do part of the job. Or both jobs, and you should really these days expect a fullback to be able to play out wide for the forward, and likewise, as you've seen a few times with Jack Harrison, it should be possible for a winger to play as a fullback as well. So it has become a bit, it's become one in the same, and that's why you can be so effective out wide, because people do know exactly what they're doing in all areas, and actually Leeds have been very good in those positions. Alioski was a good example of somebody who you could play for the forward, you could play at the back, but who knew how to marry up with whoever was either in front of him or behind him. And actually, Strouk's really surprised me in that position. He clearly understands it very well, but also is extremely mobile. And it's not that he's ever looked like he isn't mobile, it's just that once you get out into the wide areas, being mobile is a totally different consideration to being mobile at centre-back.
Do you not remember Jason Pearce with his brief stint at left-back once? That was quite an inspiring thing, wasn't it?
It sort of faded from the memory that I can well believe that it might have happened, put it that way.
I think he was playing left wing back in one game. He was quite a threat from big...
A natural fit.
A kind of diagonal balls and goal kicks. We were sort of aiming for a left back's head.
You know that like Melia likes to chip it out to the full back, so maybe he'd be perfect for that sort of role.
When you say he was quite effective, which game was this?
It's one we almost certainly lost. I think that there would have been sendings off or injuries or something. It was quite a drastic reshuffle and... Yeah, he looked completely lost out there.
All right, well, here's some homework for you this week. Come back to us next week with the details of this, because I'm quite fascinated.
And back to Brighton then, and a pain in the arse tea time kickoff on Saturday. You're heading down to this one?
Yes, down on the train back on Sunday. A little bit like Spurs. The trains are hard going, actually. It's not a problem actually being on them. It's getting on them in the first place. There aren't anywhere near enough running. They're having a much better season this season, Brighton. And one of the things that's changed with them is that last year, everybody banged on all year about their expected goals ratio, because it was miles behind the expected goals calculation was miles ahead of the number they were actually scoring. I think they scored about 40 in the end, but should, according to the stats, have scored about 55, 56. It's pretty much bang on this time round. They've been good. There's been a lot of talk of Graham Potter for England somewhere further down the line. I still feel like this is the sort of game, like Southampton away, like quite a few fixtures recently, where you expect Leeds to go there and have a chance, you know, to go there and do something. They were poor last season by all accounts, although I was 2 days on from surgery, so I can't profess to know anything about that game whatsoever, but apparently it was Brighton's day.
It was pretty woeful, wasn't it, last season? We just didn't turn up at all.
It feels like that's always the case against Brighton. I was actually looking back. Our last win down there was Fab Delph with the win, with a goal. So, I mean, it's a long way.
That 70-yard run?
Yeah, that was the last time we actually won down there. The last time we got a point down there, Michael Brown scored. So it's a while since we've got anything. In fact, you'll know this one, Phil. When we beat them in 2017, was it after that game that you said we were definitely in the playoffs?
That's right, yeah. The Chris Wood header. Yeah. That's the last win over them. I mean, we've seen some pretty grim days and nights down there. There was being, I think, Steve Evans when they were about 8-0 down at half-time. But then there was the Monk game where Phillips got sent off in the first half.
Cooper get sent off as well once down there?
Probably.
maybe it was an own goal. Bad things have always happened there.
I remember Cooper getting that long ban after Reading for stamping on somebody. But I mean, that Delph goal, that goes back to 2010, I think. That's a lot. No, sorry, 2009. That's a long, long time ago. I think Trundle scored that day as well.
I prefer to remember happier memories of Brighton, like El Hadj Diouf, for example, grabbing his crotch and getting sent off. A perfect way to end the season.
Yes, that was a highlight. That was that day when McDermott was asked, was that a fair red card? Yes.
But it's funny, isn't it? I mean, it's because I was chatting with one of my mates about this and we'd blurred together that game, which was the last home game of the previous season, was the 12 or 13, I think, when like Warnock had been sacked on April the 1st, hadn't he? And then,
that's right.
Did McDermott come in for the end of that one, or was it Redders at that point?
No, McDermott came straight in and there was that home game against Brighton and then started the following season, which was the Luke Murphy day.
We effectively had two consecutive home games against Brighton, albeit split across two seasons. And I think the suspension that Diouf had from grabbing his crotch carried over to the next home game, didn't it?
Oh, happy memories. Happy memories. But yeah, you're right. I mean, you do. I always think of Cardiff as a particularly miserable place to go. Nothing ever seems to go right down at Cardiff with rare exceptions.
We're overdue one then, aren't we? You'll be fine.
Well, yeah. But also, I mean, aside from all that, I've never kind of followed the theory that getting trounced under Steve Evans means that Leeds are in some way handicapped going there, you know, 5 years later under Bielsa.
Mind you, I would, for older fans, I would say Oldham in the 80s and even perhaps into the 90s always stuck as a place where we never got anything and it was awful. It was cold up the top of that hill.
For the sake of argument, I understand why Leeds get very little at Millwall, because Millwall are absolutely demented for that fixture and get into it in such a big way. And it is a hard atmosphere to play in. And I think it's always an atmosphere that Millwall really, really like when Leeds are there and seems to do good things for them. Brighton, I can't say, is the same, really. And
oh, it's very hostile, the way they put on the nice local ale in the away end and stuff. Oh, it's fierce.
Well, you see, when I was in Norwich a few weeks back, the trains were delayed. I sound like the rail police here. But so I wanted a pint just to kill an hour or so. And I went over the road to this pub, which said home fans only. And I said to the guy on the door, listen, you know, I'm just down.
Do you know who I am? Is that what you said?
No, I did not say that. But I said, I'm just down to cover the game. Because he just had no idea. I'm just down to cover the game, working as a journalist in there. I just want to come in for a pint. Can I see your driving licence? Where are you from? I said, I'm from, you know, from Edinburgh originally, but I live up in York. He says to me, be a brave man to go in there on your own coming from York. I was like, well, I'm not sure there's that much jeopardy involved in going into this pub with about 30 Norwich fans in. But
What did you find inside? Come on, you've got to finish.
Well, no, I wasn't allowed in.
It didn't let you in?
No. I had to go back to the station.
You've got a scar on your head now. You look menacing. He probably he's causing bother, this guy.
Is it the Coleman's Ultras, was it?
It's not menacing enough, but yeah, the Coleman's Ultras, which is, you know, like the Brighton Rock Ultras, really. So if you go to Spurs and you get beat, even in those circumstances, you can be philosophical and saying, well, if players like Kane and so on turn it on, then, you know, that's kind of likely to happen. I think if you go to Brighton and get beat, you're far more disappointed about the fact that you haven't matched up to them. And while they've had a good season so far, let's be honest, these are the games that
have they?
What decent season?
Well, they had 4 wins out of 5 at the start and they've done nothing since.
Yeah, but they're up in kind of 7th, 8th. It's been all right.
But I think that's by virtue of the fact that they had a good start. They've not really done anything since. Like, if you look at the form table, they're not great.
No, not great at all. But I think they'll be relatively happy with where they are.
I mean, they've got twice as many wins as we have, but I'm just saying, I'm just thinking in terms of them having a good season. It started well, but has it gone that well since? I don't know.
It's been all right. But these are the games come November, December, if you're in the position Leeds are in, that you've got to be getting into. You've got to be getting into in a big way. And Bielsa was saying today that he thinks that they're a few points shy of where they should be on the basis of performances. But he was very, very open. I said, I'm not hiding from or ignoring at all the fact that we are, where we are in the table, and that the results have put us there, and that we've got to sort that out. But this is what I mean. I don't think Brighton are an outstanding team, but they would feel that they've had a better season than Leeds so far.
By and large, have Potter's Brighton had Bielsa's number? I'm trying to think of the games we've experienced so far. Is it just the two from last season? Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty small number of games to be sure about. You do find that from time to time. Gary Monk had this weird trend on occasions of coming in and doing Leeds over, but I'm not sure about Potter. I mean, you'll know more than me about the game last season, but it did sound as if it was just Brighton's afternoon.
Well, it wasn't just that. We just didn't turn up. There was nothing. It was one of those classic Leeds kind of can't even pass to each other type performances, just conceding possession, no ideas. It was just weird. It was a weird game.
Was it the last game on the bad pitch as well? I seem to remember. I think we replaced the pitch after Brighton.
We played away, didn't we? We were playing away.
The
home game.
The home game was.
So we can blame the pitch for that one. That's fine.
The pitch was dismal. And at the back end of last season,
there was nothing at stake.
There were no crowds. Nobody cared. So it doesn't count.
Fine. We've got excuses for both of those. I don't know. I'm getting a growing sense that we're going to be all right this season, as terrifying as our league position can be. There's got to be something in this series of games for us now.
If we were to get less than 3 points from the next two games, would you still feel that way?
No, I'd be crapping myself. But I don't know. I just look at this side. I think there's a lot more to come from it. We're better than our league position would suggest. And plenty of teams have said that in the past. Let's not dress it up. We need to start getting some points. But
that's what I mean, though. This is the time where you have to actually deliver on that, as opposed to just finding yourself saying that for week after week. I certainly think if you take the best parts of the more recent games as opposed to the early part of the season, there's definite improvement there, and it does feel like it's coming.
So ignore the bad bits, take the good bits.
Yeah, so the opposite to what you were doing with Brighton. the total opposite. But these are games you have to go in. They are due a game that leads, that they win, and they win in some style, and they come away from either at home or away thinking, that's what we're about, that's what we are. It was almost there against Leicester. It was just missing the winning goal. And it felt like it was there in the first half against Spurs, but it does feel like we're kind of stuck in this cycle of saying it's maybe not that far away.
But you're right, what you were saying about how you perceive that fixture against Spurs, where you go, it'd be nice to get something from that, but in a roundabout way, you don't really expect to. And then there are other probably next tier up games that you look at on the fixture list, like, you know, Man City, Liverpool, etc., Chelsea, and you go, well, you know, we're probably not going to get anything out of those because they're just streets and streets ahead, you know, in terms of budget, players and all the rest of it. So fine, we write those ones off. These are the ones we need to get something from. You look at that Brighton fixture and think, yeah, there's no reason why we can't. We just have to turn up and do our job again.
Which I feel like they will. I feel like they will turn up. I felt that at Spurs. I just thought it was going to end up being Conte's day, because those occasions quite often work out like that. This will be really tight and it'll be really close. I don't think there'll be much in it at all. And it feels very much to me like a game where first goal wins. But it could be Leeds. I think they will be stronger for having Rafinha back, for one. I think they'll be in a bit better frame of mind, really, having played as they did against Leicester and as they did in the first half against Spurs. And I do hope it's coming.
All right, then on to Palace, and Conor Gallagher finally comes home, etc. And what do we expect from that one?
Well, he's the player to keep an eye on. I mean, he has been a really, really good signing for them and really effective.
He's not Adam Forshaw, though, is he?
No, I think he probably thinks of himself as a different player to Adam Forshaw. But that's a risky thing to say. That's Michael and I are going to kill you.
Just for the avoidance of doubt, because this is an audio medium, my tongue was planted firmly in my cheek with that one.
If you say so.
I went full Radrizzani.
I wondered about Palace, and I what I mean is I wondered if they would have they'd be set up for quite a tricky year, because they'd appointed Vieira. You weren't quite sure how that was going to go. Squad didn't look brilliant. It didn't look terrible, but you know, it wasn't kind of, there are good aspects to it, but I wasn't sure how it was all going to click. I think they'll be pretty happy with where they are, 10th at the moment, and in pretty reasonable fettle. That's, again, another kind of tricky fixture, but at home, Crystal Palace, again, Leeds have got to be winning that.
It's there for the taking, isn't it?
They've got to be winning that game, yeah.
I always think, I don't know, I keep looking at like these fixtures, these potentially winnable, I'm doing the air quotes now, winnable fixtures, and I always think with these, and it's the same thing I would say about the whole season, Leeds' biggest challenge this season is overcoming Leeds.
Yeah, and also just doing what they do well. I think that's a little bit of what's gone out of them this season, is that the good aspects and the really dependable and reliable aspects of Bielsa's football haven't been what they were previously. But the fact that you can see it coming in patches is encouraging because it hasn't gone completely. And to go back to the Ayling interview, again, there's just no sense in there of something. And Ayling is not the sort of guy who would say, well, do you know what? I've gone further than I've gone before. So if it all falls apart, then, you know, we've all made a bit of money. We've all had a bit of success. Jobs are good. And you very much sense with him that they do feel like it's still there and they don't feel like this squad is done at all. But I suspect that now we're almost into December, they will be saying to themselves, you know, we've got to start doing it now.
What do you fancy from these two games? And you can almost throw Brentford into the mix with this, can't you? As a third in these three sort of fixtures where you'd expect to get something. What will we get? What do you think we'll get?
I think they're going to get 7 points. I think they're going to win at Brighton.
Out of the next two.
Magic. I think they're going to win at Brighton. I think they're going to draw with Palace. I think they're going to beat Brentford.
Okay. Michael, look,
here we go.
Looks really upset. I mean, you generally have been quite accurate in terms of forecasting the general mood and the outcomes from games, Phil, whereas I tend to lead with heart rather than head often.
Palace, I think, have things about them that will cause Leeds problems, Zaha and so on. Brighton, I think if you compete with Brighton, then they're a beatable team. And I just think Rafinha coming back in, hopefully pretty fresh, will help. And with Brentford, I'm not saying the bubble sort of burst there entirely, but it's been pretty difficult for them since that flying start.
The reality's kind of setting in the Premier League, isn't it?
It is, in a way that it never really did for Leeds. You know, it never really set in to the extent last season where you were thinking, that's actually been quite a while since Leeds got anything from a game or got a win on the board. It was never like that.
It's this season instead.
Well, yeah, no, definitely. But for Brentford, there is that sense of them just going backwards a little bit.
I feel like we're looking for a definitive bit of form within this period, and I think we're going to get a non-definitive 4 points from the games, which will just keep us, it'll keep us out of the relegation zone, but with a little bit of a worry going into our bad run of fixtures.
Who are they losing to, though?
No, don't say it. Just imagine us, though, sitting here in a fortnight going into that next difficult run of games, whatever. Extra 9 points on the
board.
That's
the thing. If we can 9 points there, it pretty much sorts us out for December because we'll have enough of a cushion that we can go, right, well, anything from these is a bonus.
And you're looking at the second half of the season thinking, well, we've got 20 points in that half of the season. All we need to do is do that again and we're comfortably safe. So that's what's going to happen, isn't it?
Yeah.
are you going for 9 points, Daniel?
I'm prepared to be optimistic because I do believe in this side. I mean, the likelihood of us winning three on the bounce, given that it's the Premier League and given how tight it all is, probably not 9 points, but why not aspire to it?
Seven. I'm going seven.
Four.
Well, we do know that it will be a number and one of us will be more right than the others. But we will deal with Brentford next week in the wake of these two games.
Hopefully my 4 points prediction is already wrong by then because, oh, actually it could be wrong if we lose both either. Okay. Hopefully we've already won two games by then.
Hopefully it's in it's all in hand. Just one thing, bit more serious that I promised I would do. I was messaged on Twitter by a guy called Rob Davies yesterday who said that his son, Ben, had a really serious accident this week and was in intensive care in hospital. Big Leeds fan. They're big fans of the podcast as well. Just wanted to send our best wishes and thoughts.
All right, get well soon. And we will wrap up the Phil Hay Show there. Of course, sign up for The Athletic if you haven't yet. Best offer of the year. The Black Friday sale is on now. That finishes at midnight on the 29th. That is Monday, the 29th. So get in before that deadline and don't miss out. TheAthletic.com/LeedsPod. We'll speak to you next week.
The Phil Hay Show.